For most of human history, agriculture has basically operated on this really fundamental, almost unspoken contract with the sky.
Right.
I mean, you put a seed in the dirt, and eventually water falls from above. It's honestly a lot like flipping a light switch in your house.
Yeah, you flick the switch, the light comes on, you plant the seed, the rain comes down.
Exactly. It's binary, and we've built our entire global civilization around that predictability.
And that baseline level of predictability is, well, it's the invisible foundation holding up the entire global food system. Without it, the math of human survival gets very complicated very quickly.
Which is exactly why things are getting so tense right now. Because, I mean, what happens when you flip that switch and literally nothing happens?
Or what if it just flickers for a few seconds before going pitch black for months?
Right. So today, we're doing a deep dive into this really fascinating intelligence briefing from the year 2026. It's simply titled Texto Collado.
Yeah, an incredible document.
It really is. And our mission here is to figure out exactly how scientists, farmers, and, entire communities are completely rewiring our global food supply to survive a world where water is scarce.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to accept that severe heat stress and prolonged dry spells are, they're just no longer anomalies.
No, they're the norm.
Exactly, they are the new baseline. We've moved way past the point where adopting drought-resilient crops is just some cool niche agricultural experiment.
Yeah.
This blueprint makes it crystal clear that overhauling our soil practices and genetics is now an absolute strategic necessity to keep the world fed.
Okay, let's unpack this because I know what some of you listening might be thinking right now. You might live in a high rise on 20th floor.
Right, miles away from a field.
Exactly. You might not own a farm, and maybe your only interaction with agriculture is, I don't know, picking out a halfway decent melon at the grocery store.
Which is most people, honestly.
Yeah, so why should you care about root depths and soil tech? Well, even if you never touch a tractor in your life, these innovations are the invisible infrastructure keeping your grocery store shelves from going empty.
Oh, absolutely.
They dictate global market stability, the price you pay for basic staples, and quite frankly, humanity's ability to ride out these massive climate shifts.
The ripple effects touch absolutely everyone.
Yeah.
The transition detailed in this material operates on multiple layers, starting all the way down at the biological baseline of the plants themselves, long before we even get into the high-tech farming methods.
Let's start right there, because I really want to understand what these specific plants are doing differently to survive when, everything else around them is just burning up.
Right.
The source highlights these heat-tolerant grains, right, like sorghum and millet, as the backbone of this whole 2026 strategy.
Yeah, and sorghum and millet are incredibly resilient because they originally evolved in arid regions. Nature has already done, millions of years of R&D on them.
That's a good way to look at it.
They utilize very short growing cycles, meaning they reach maturity before the absolute worst of the heat hits. But their real superpower is actually underground.
Under the soil.
Yeah, they develop these incredibly deep, robust root systems. And this structural advantage drastically reduces what scientists call evapotranspiration losses.
Okay, evapotranspiration. Is that essentially just like the plant sweating?
That is a very good way to picture it, actually. Just like a human sweats to cool down, a plant releases moisture through its leaves into the hot air around it.
Right, makes sense.
But if the air is bone dry and incredibly hot, the plant can lose moisture way faster than it can replace it.
Oh, wow.
So by having much deeper roots, sorghum and millet can tap into moisture locked far beneath that baked surface crust. They pull up water that other crops simply can't reach, and they use that water much more efficiently within their cellular structure.
That makes perfect sense. And then the briefing shifts to legumes, stuff like chickpeas, cowpeas, and pigeon peas.
Yes.
And it mentions this specific biological trait they have called drought escape.
A great term.
Right. When I read that, it instantly made me think of like a guest leaving a party right before the snacks run out.
That's exactly what they do.
Essentially, these early maturing legumes sense the dry season coming. So they just hit the gas pedal. They rush to finish their entire growth cycle and produce their seeds, which is, the food we actually eat, before the late season dry spells hit and the water completely disappears.
Right. They get in, get the job done, and escape before the conditions turn lethal.
Exactly.
And what's fascinating here is how these legumes don't just survive the harsh environment, they actively repair it for the next crop.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They possess this incredible ability called biological nitrogen fixation.
Okay.
They have this symbiotic relationship with bacteria on their roots that literally pulls nitrogen gas out of the atmosphere and converts it into natural fertilizer right there in the dirt.
Wait, so which means the farmer doesn't have to buy and spray nearly as much expensive synthetic chemical fertilizer.
Precisely. It's the opposite of a vicious cycle. And when farmers intercrop, meaning, you know, planting these drought-adapted legumes in the exact same field alongside the deep-rooted cereals, it improves the entire system's reliability.
Huh. You would naturally assume two different plants in the same dry field would fiercely compete for scarce water.
Right. That's the old way of thinking. Instead, their different root structures create a cooperative underground ecosystem. The deep roots pull water up, the shallow legume roots fix the nitrogen, and together they capture resources far better than either could alone.
That's like building a complementary sports team where one player's specific strengths cover the other's blind spots.
Exactly.
And this biological resilience isn't just for human consumption either. Our 2026 blueprint emphasizes perennial forages for livestock, too.
Yes, incredibly important.
Things like drought-adapted Bermuda grass and specific clovers.
Vital for ranchers, honestly. These perennial forages have an incredible capacity to enter a state of dormancy during severe stress, only to aggressively regrow the moment a little moisture returns.
Wow, just bringing back to life.
Yeah. By integrating them into grazing rotations, ranchers don't have to panic and buy expensive supplemental feed during a dry season. The deep roots hold the soil together, animal health is maintained, and the water infiltration actually improves over time.
Nature has clearly provided a really fantastic baseline here. But humanity isn't just sitting back and hoping evolution works fast enough to save us.
No, definitely not.
We are actively designing 2026 seed. And this takes us from, like, natural biology to human-driven breeding.
Yeah.
The scale of the genomic tools they're using is just wild.
It really is.
They mentioned marker-assisted selection. What exactly does that look like in practice? Are they just like looking through a microscope all day?
It is much, much faster than that. Imagine scanning a barcode on the plant's DNA.
Okay.
Historically, a breeder would cross two plants, plant the resulting seed, wait an entire season, and then try to guess if the roots grew deep enough based on how the plant looked above ground.
That sounds incredibly tedious.
It was. Now, they don't have to wait. They scan the seed's DNA for the exact genetic marker, the barcode that controls root depth.
Oh, wow.
Or they look for the gene that dictates stomatal control, which is the mechanism the plant uses to open and close its microscopic pores to lock moisture inside.
I also saw a term in the briefing called osmotic adjustment. It sounded like some kind of fancy water filtration system.
It's actually a brilliant cellular defense mechanism. When the soil gets extremely dry, a normal plant's internal water just gets sucked out into the dry dirt through osmosis.
Because the dirt is drier than the plant.
Exactly. But a plant with strong osmotic adjustment can actively accumulate sugars and other solutes inside its own cells. It essentially makes its internal water thicker or more concentrated.
Okay.
And that thicker internal pressure prevents the water from being pulled out into the dry soil, keeping the plant hydrated against all odds.
That is incredible. And by finding these specific barcodes, scientists can create commercial seeds featuring what they call trait stacking and hybrid vigor.
Yes. So hybrid vigor happens when you cross two genetically distant plant lines.
Right.
And the offspring essentially masks all the recessive weaker traits of the parents, which results in explosive early root growth and just massive resilience.
And then they stack them.
Right. Then they stack those traits. They take the osmotic adjustment gene, stack it with a pest resistance gene, and stack that with the deep root gene, creating this highly stable, high-yielding commercial seed.
Okay, wait, hold on. Here's where it gets really interesting, and honestly, where my alarm bells start ringing a bit.
Sure.
If we're relying on a handful of commercial high-tech labs to engineer these expensive super seeds, aren't we essentially putting all our eggs in one corporate basket?
That is a very common concern.
I mean, what happens to the local traditional varieties that have survived for centuries? If that one hyper-engineered lab seed fails against an unexpected disease, doesn't an entire region just starve?
That is a very valid skepticism, and the architects of this 2026 blueprint address that tension head on. Relying solely on a monolithic commercial pipeline is dangerous.
Yeah, it has to be.
While commercial hybrids offer incredible vigor, the briefing emphasizes that success absolutely requires something called participatory breeding.
Participatory breeding? meaning the farmers themselves are co-designing the seeds.
Engaging the local farmers directly in the selection process is non-negotiable.
Oh, I see.
Think about it. A high-tech lab in another hemisphere might breed a seed that survives a drought perfectly. But if the resulting grain tastes terrible, or can't be stored in local clay silos without rotting, or requires massive amounts of manual labor to process, the farmers simply will not adopt it.
Right. It doesn't matter how drought-resistant it is if nobody wants to eat it.
Exactly. Community-based seed systems preserve vital genetic diversity. By linking the formal high-tech genomic programs with the lived experience of local farmers, we ensure that culturally critical traits aren't bulldozed by corporate efficiency.
That makes a lot of sense. You absolutely need the genomic barcode scanner, but it's worthless without the local farmer's palate and, you know, generational knowledge.
Precisely.
But let's pivot a bit, because even the most genetically perfect, culturally adapted, high-vigor seed is going to die if the physical environment is completely hostile.
Oh, without a doubt.
We have to prep the battlefield. So how are farmers physically manipulating the dirt and water to keep these seeds alive?
Conserving soil moisture is step one. The material outlines foundational practices like mulching, where farmers leave the previous season's crop residue, the dead stalks and leaves layered over the soil like a protective blanket.
Just leaving the dead plants there.
Yeah, it blocks the sun and drastically reduces surface evaporation. And you combine that with no-till farming.
Okay.
Instead of ripping up the earth with a plow, which exposes that nice moist underlayer to the hot air, they leave the soil structure intact.
So it's entirely focused on trapping whatever rogue drops of water actually fall.
Exactly.
And when they do have to artificially add water, the technology is incredibly precise. We're talking about subsurface drip irrigation driven by soil moisture sensors and decision support systems that pull in satellite imagery.
Yes, wild.
They can see exactly what is happening 2 feet under the ground without ever digging a hole. But the concept that really blew my mind was deficit irrigation.
Ah, yes.
When I first saw that term, it sounded completely backward. I mean, aren't we trying to give the plants water, not put them in a deficit?
It sounds totally counterintuitive to deliberately starve a crop of water. But think of it like medical triage in an emergency room following a mass casualty event.
Triage? How so?
Well, in triage, you don't have enough resources to give everyone luxury treatment.
Right.
So you allocate exactly what is needed to keep the most critical patients alive.
Right. Making hard choices.
Deficit irrigation works the exact same way. Instead of keeping the field constantly soaked, the automated sensors tell the farmer to deliberately withhold water during the plant's less important vegetative growth phases.
Wow. So you actually stress the plant out a little bit.
Exactly. You stress it a little bit, but then you deliver a highly targeted dose of water exactly when the plant begins flowering or filling its grain. Those are the critical moments that dictate the harvest size. It stretches a tiny reservoir of water over a massive area without causing a catastrophic drop in the final yield.
That is brilliant.
But this raises an important question. Are we becoming dangerously reliant on million-dollar sensor networks and satellite uplinks?
Yeah, I was wondering that.
High-tech triage is powerful, but it requires capital, training, and reliable electricity. What about resource-limited smallholder farmers?
Right, the farmers who can't just, you know, download a satellite moisture app on their phones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the blueprint proves that resilience doesn't always require a microchip. Low-cost, traditional innovations often provide the absolute highest return on investment. The text specifically details the resurgence of Zypits and stone buns.
Okay, what is a Zypit exactly? It sounds ancient.
It is an ancient and brilliant technique. Before the rainy season, a farmer digs a massive grid of small, shallow holes across a dry, crusted field.
Yeah.
Then they drop a small handful of organic matter, like animal manure, into each hole. And that manure attracts local termites.
Wait. Termites. Why on earth would you intentionally invite termites to your farm?
Because the termites dig these extensive underground tunnel networks radiating out from the bottom of the pit.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. When the erratic rains finally hit, the water doesn't just flash flood and wash away over the hard-baked earth. It pools into the Zaya pits and funnels deep down into the termite tunnels.
So the entire field essentially acts like a giant subterranean sponge.
Exactly. You get phenomenal water capture and targeted root moisture for literally $0 in technology.
That is amazing.
And then you add stone buns, which are just these low walls of rocks built along the natural contours of the hills to slow down runoff, and you've completely transformed the landscape's hydrology.
Okay, so we have superseeds, we have satellite triage, and we have termite sponges. But let's look at the elephant in the room here, the cost.
Always the big hurdle.
Farming operates on razor-thin margins. If I'm a small farmer living harvest to harvest, how on earth do I afford to overhaul my entire operation to implement these 2026 strategies?
The economics are undeniably the ultimate bottleneck. The transition requires upfront seed costs, new tools, and honestly, just the sheer financial risk of trying something new.
Which is terrifying if your family's food is on the line.
Exactly. The farmer has to carefully weigh those initial costs against the long-term gains, which usually show up years later as lower irrigation bills and reduced fertilizer use. It requires serious financial scaffolding.
And the briefing provides three massive global case studies that prove this financial scaffolding actually works. Let's look at East Africa first.
Sure.
They had incredible success scaling dryland sorghum specifically, improved varieties that matured early to dodge droughts. But the breakthrough wasn't just, you know, dropping bags of seeds from a truck.
No, handing out free seeds is just a Band-Aid. The East African success really hinged on building cooperative seed multiplication networks.
Seed multiplication?
Yeah. NGOs and local governments partnered directly with farming collectives, training them to grow, harvest, and distribute the improved seeds themselves.
Oh, so keeping it in the community.
Exactly. The communities owned the intellectual and physical property, creating an entirely self-sustaining local economy that didn't rely on expensive annual imports.
That is so smart. Then you jump over to South Asia. They focused on pulse production stuff like chickpeas and pigeon peas, trying to survive incredibly erratic monsoons.
Right.
They successfully grew the crops using those drought escape traits we talked about earlier. But their economic survival relied on something that happens long after the tractor is parked, which is post-harvest storage.
It's a tragic irony when a farmer successfully beats a drought, harvests a great crop, and then loses half of it to rot or pests because they don't have proper storage.
Heartbreaking, really.
It is. So by rolling out extensive training on hermetically sealed storage bags and community silos, South Asian farmers drastically reduced their spoilage.
Which changes everything.
It does. That allowed them to hold on to their grain and sell it months later when market prices were high, rather than being forced to dump it at rock-bottom prices immediately after harvest.
For everyone listening, this is that invisible infrastructure I mentioned earlier. Storage tech in South Asia is what prevents massive market fluctuations that spike the cost of your groceries.
Exactly.
And the final case study takes us to Australia, looking at regenerative cattle grazing.
Yes. Australian ranchers integrated those deep-rooted perennial forages into their massive pastures, but the real management shift was adopting adaptive stocking rates.
Which is essentially treating a herd of cattle like a dynamic accordion, right?
That's a really great visual, actually. Instead of maintaining a static number of animals year-round, which leads to devastating overgrazing when a drought inevitably kills the grass, the ranchers expand and contract the size of their herd.
Like opening and closing an accordion.
Yes, in perfect rhythm with the rainfall and available forage. By dynamically adjusting that accordion, they maintain the health of the remaining animals, dramatically increase the amount of carbon captured in their soil, and completely slash their spending on emergency hay and feed.
So what does this all mean? How does a heavily risk-averse farmer, someone who is terrified of making a mistake that could cost their family's livelihood, actually start this process?
The 2026 blueprint offers a very pragmatic implementation roadmap. You don't overhaul a multi-generational farm overnight.
Of course not.
You begin with a granular vulnerability assessment.
Mm.
What are the specific water constraints of your exact soil type? What local markets will actually pay you for growing a new type of millet?
You do the math before you buy the seed.
Always. Then you pilot small plots. You test the drought-resistant varieties on a tiny fraction of your land. You observe how they perform under your specific management style before committing to a full-scale rollout.
De-risking the whole thing.
Exactly. And crucially, this transition has to be de-risked by outside forces, too. Governments and international bodies like the FAO have to step in with microfinance loans and specialized crop insurance. And we have to track socioeconomic indicators just as closely as we track crop yields. Is this new farming method increasing the labor burden on women in the community? Is it genuinely improving local market access?
Looking at the whole picture.
Yes. Longitudinal data ensures the humans are becoming as resilient as the plants.
It really is a complete systemic paradigm shift.
Hmm.
We've traced the journey from the microscopic, you know, thickened cellular water inside a cowpea through high-tech DNA barcode scanners out into the termite-driven Zai pits of East Africa and all the way up to adaptive herd accordions in Australia.
It's an incredible spectrum.
It is. And for those of you listening, this text isn't just an agricultural manual. It is the ultimate blueprint for human adaptability. It proves that combining deeply rooted, local traditional knowledge with hyper-advanced precision technology is the absolute only way we're going to keep the global food chain intact for all of us.
It is a phenomenal blueprint for survival. And honestly, it leaves me with a final thought for you to mull over.
Let's hear it.
We've spent all this time discussing how we are successfully re-engineering our agriculture to thrive on a fraction of the water, using targeted triage, subterranean termite sponges, and drought escape principles.
Right.
What happens when we start applying these exact same survival mechanisms to the design of our modern cities?
Oh, wow.
Think about it. If a field of chickpeas can be engineered to capture every single rogue drop of rain, aggressively minimize its evaporation, and cycle its own nutrients, shouldn't our urban infrastructure be designed to do the exact same thing?
That is a wild thought. Designing a concrete city to survive a drought exactly like a chickpea does.
It changes how you look at a city, doesn't it?
It really does. It just goes to show how much we have to learn from the biological systems that sustain us. Because as we've learned today, that old contract with the sky, that reliable light switch we've been flicking for thousands of years expecting rain, is broken.
Completely broken.
But instead of just sitting in the dark, we are finally learning how to completely rewire the house.